Welcome to TwipCast, episode 34, HolmesCast. Today we begin our biopic on the porn industry, beginning with John Holmes, the infamous Long Dong Silver. This is the teaser for my Las Vegas cast, the One-Armed Bandit. First, we'll be discussing the other famous Holmes, Sherlock, quite elementary. Today, I'd like to introduce you to executive producer James Caswell, man most likely to sidekick along Basil Rathbone as Dr. John Watson.
And he's Doug Zeitlin, co-executive producer of Timewell Electronic Recording Productions, and the Natalie to my Adrian Monk.
Oh, no, not. Since we are not discussing John Holmes, let's talk about that famous character created by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle in 1887. What do you have to tell us, Jim?
Well, originally, Sherlock Holmes was featured in 4 novels and 56 short stories, all of which were written by Arthur Conan Doyle. The first story, A Study in Scarlet, appeared in Beaton's Christmas Annual in 1887. Doyle said that the character of Holmes was inspired by Dr. Joseph Bell, who he had worked for as a clerk at the Edinburgh Royal Infirmary. Bell was well known for drawing conclusions from the smallest observations. In 1891, Doyle tried to kill off Holmes because he wanted to concentrate more on writing historical novels in the book The Adventure of the Final Problem.
Adventure of the Final Problem. 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 Problem.
However, the demand was so great for more Holmes stories that he was asked to return. I guess it could be considered the first example of a fan write-in campaign. Holmes returned in 1894 with The Adventure of the Empty House, where it was explained that the confrontation that Watson saw between Holmes and Moriarty, yes, they did indeed plunge into the waterfall, but Holmes managed to survive, had temporary amnesia, and was now returning. Obviously, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle became well known primarily for his work with Sherlock Holmes, as opposed to those historical novels that he wanted to write so dearly. Doyle did pass away on July 7th, 1930.
All right, Jim, so we know that Sherlock Holmes has been around since 1887. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle certainly didn't create detective fiction. So what really is the impact of Sherlock Holmes then?
Holmes has become, over time, the archetype of the detective. The idea of matching wits with the criminal element and using brain power over muscles is one of the best known traits of Sherlock Holmes. Doyle also refined the role of the loyal assistant in Dr. Watson. Holmes was one of the first characters to use forensics and psychology in detective work long before it was popular and long before it was actually used by law enforcement officials.
You could actually say that Sherlock Holmes was the original CSI.
Yes, very much so. And in spite of the fact that Professor Moriarty was really only used once, and that was in The Adventures of the Final Problem, he is considered one of the original criminal masterminds. And he's considered that because of the fact that Holmes said he's a brilliant criminal mastermind. And that's all it took.
I think that we kind of went from Moriarty to Hannibal Lecter. One of the many elements that has fascinated people about Hannibal Lecter, outside of the fact that he's a cannibal, is the fact that he is a criminal mastermind. He is supposed to be a genius-level character.
I think in the modern age, that term is bandied around an awful lot. Probably in part because of comic books and in part because of movies and things of that nature. But in the 1880s, the idea of a criminal mastermind, somebody who was a genius who decided to use their intellect for evil rather than for the betterment of society, was a really strange concept. But how many of these characters are truly criminal masterminds as much as they just happen to be smarter than the people that are chasing them?
That's actually a really good point. There's that case here in the Chicagoland area recently where the guy was luring drug-addictive women into his house using drugs, and then he was killing them. I mean, he was not much of a criminal mastermind, but he certainly was deranged.
Yeah, and there's a huge difference between being deranged and being a criminal mastermind. You can be a criminal mastermind and be deranged, don't get me wrong. Hannibal Lecter is an excellent example of that. But you don't have to be a criminal mastermind to be deranged.
I agree. Look at world politics. I'm talking about real people like Muammar Gaddafi and Kim Jong-il. I mean, these people are, you know, holding millions of people under their thumbs. They are masterminds.
And they're criminal. You don't do the type of stuff that they do to their own subjects and go, oh, well, isn't that nice?
No, you try not to.
If you do, you're probably a criminal mastermind in and of yourself. I mean, after all, Stewie Griffin does identify with these people.
True enough. What does that say about Seth MacFarlane?
The truest evil genius of them all.
Anyways, we digress. Let's talk a little bit more about Sherlock Holmes. I mean, he's been more than just a book character. He shows up in all sorts of media. Let's start with television so that we could springboard that into our films.
Oh, there have been so many television adaptations. The only thing that I think there's been more of than television adaptations is film adaptations. Foremost among them, among the Sherlockians, or the Holmesians, or whatever they call themselves, are the Jeremy Brett series from 1984 to 1994 that ran on BBC and later in our area on PBS. It was produced by Granada Television for BBC, and as I said, it's considered the most faithful adaptations of the original stories. I grew up watching those with my dad all the time. I have them on DVD, and in all modesty, I have to agree, they are some of the best renditions of the stories that has ever been produced, the most faithful, and Jeremy Brett just did a wonderful job up until he died of cancer. As Star Trek fans, we'd be remiss if we didn't mention Data's fascination with the Great Detective and several Star Trek episodes that were dedicated to Data portraying Sherlock Holmes with Geordi LaForge as his Dr. Watson. Again, one of my favorite versions of the Sherlock Holmes archetype just finished its run on USA, which was Monk. I don't think anyone could sit there and watch that show and not go, oh, he's a version of Sherlock Holmes.
Even something like House is supposed to be a medical Sherlock Holmes.
Given everything that I've read, I've never really been into House as a series. He's just too curmudgeon-y for me to care one way or the other about him. But I wonder if it would actually be more fair to say that House is a modern-day Dr. Bell.
That's an interesting analogy, and I can see exactly where you're going with that. I guess for the average person, I think that would be too esoteric a reference. But House intentionally has a lot of things in common with Sherlock Holmes. He lives at the same house address, 221B. Holmes was addicted to cocaine. House is addicted to painkillers. I mean, there's a significant attempt to make House a medical Sherlock Holmes.
And yet I still don't like the show because he's way too curmudgeon-y. Go figure.
I don't know what to say about that. Imagine if you set Star Trek on a ship with tall sails. I mean, you got Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock, who obviously from the Orient, and they're going around from island to island talking to the natives, and Kirk's having sex with them. It would not be the same show. My point was that the archetype was used again.
Yes. Returning to the source, sort of, 1999 was an interesting year for Sherlock Holmes fans because they came out with an animated version of Sherlock Holmes set in the future, in the 22nd century. I watched the show, actually, for its extremely brief run because I am a Sherlock Holmes fan. And, well, it wasn't Highlander the animated series, at least.
Not saying much.
Apparently, when Sherlock Holmes passed away, he was frozen in carbonite. I mean, he was somehow frozen in suspended animation almost a century before that term would ever come into being, and he is thawed out in the 22nd century by Watson's granddaughter, who happens to be a Scotland Yard detective. Yeah, I think that pretty well sums it up right there. If you're a fan of science fiction, and you're a fan of Sherlock Holmes, well, give it a try anyway.
And that brings us to the 21st century. So starting in 2010, right around the corner at the time of recording, Stephen Moffat is creating a new Sherlock Holmes for the BBC. You may recall the name Stephen Moffat, because he's now the current showrunner for the 2010 version of Doctor Who. I say, way to go, Stephen!
If he takes over producing James Bond, he'll have the trifecta.
I can't argue with you there, Jim. So this is just kind of a brief overview of Sherlock Holmes on television. But he's been a media character
since they first started making film.
Yes. The very first known Sherlock Holmes film was a one-minute reel in 1900 created by Edison. But for serious moviegoers, Arthur Conan Doyle was able to see him in movie serials in the 1921 to 1923.
I don't know. I think the people who sat down for that very first one-minute film were probably serious moviegoers.
Yeah, all three of them that actually knew about movies in 1900.
But yes, Arthur Conan Doyle was able to see the first silent Sherlock Holmes film before he died, which would just have to be a very interesting experience to see something that you've created visualized by someone else completely and put to film.
From what I understand of Arthur Conan Doyle's vision is that once it left his work, he was really looking for whatever the new creator was looking at. I believe it was these serials where they had married off Sherlock Holmes, and they were worried that this was going to upset him, and he was like, no, right now, this is your Sherlock Holmes. Do what you want. Marry him, kill him, whatever you need to do for your story. He was very supportive.
That is incredibly open-minded. I hope someday when I'm looking at someone else taking over my work, that I can be that open-minded. Of course, I'd like to see somebody else take over some of my work.
Ba-dum-bum.
Probably the most famous Sherlock Holmes adaptations to film, though, were the Basil Rathbone series that ran in theaters from 1939 to 1946. Rathbone also played Holmes on a radio series that was going on at the same time until 1947. And I actually have a complete collection of MP3 recordings of those broadcasts.
Of the Basil Rathbone movies, only the first two were period pieces. After that, it got too expensive, and they moved it up to modern day, which would have been World War II-esque.
Yes, a lot of times it was Sherlock Holmes fighting against the Nazis.
So he was the original Indiana Jones.
Very few people have managed to duplicate the success, though, that Basil Rathbone created in that time period. There have been literally dozens of Sherlock Holmes-esque films, but very, very few of them have had a lot of success. Some of my personal favorite adaptations include Young Sherlock Holmes from 1985. It was an interesting twist on the character because it was set with him as a teenage schoolboy, first meeting Watson, and essentially solving his first crime. The second of those was just a mere 3 years later, which, again, they did a twist on the story. It was called Without a Clue, which starred Ben Kingsley as Dr. John Watson and Michael Caine as Sherlock Holmes. The twist on this one, however, was that Watson was the genius crime solver, but he didn't want the attention, so he hired an actor to play Sherlock Holmes and therefore take the credit. He preferred to be put in the bumbling sidekick role when, in fact, he was the genius. Again, a twist on the concept, but it was entertaining. I mean, it had Michael Caine in it.
I don't know if you meant that as an insult or a compliment, so I'm not going to ask. That brings us up to modern day, really, because we're just touching on them. We've got a 2010 modern rendition of Sherlock Holmes, directed by Guy Ritchie, starring Robert Downey Jr. and Jude Law. Jim, do you think this new movie holds true to the spirit of Doyle's creation?
Well, if you'd asked me that a half an hour ago, I'd probably have a different answer. But after what you just said about Arthur Conan Doyle and his outlook of you take the character and you make him whatever you need him to be to tell your story, I have to say yes, he held to Doyle's spirit of the character. Guy Ritchie needed to make the character into someone that modern-day audiences were going to pay attention to. If you had the stereotypical version of Sherlock Holmes, who spends a lot of time sitting in his parlor, playing with chemicals, thinking, playing his violin, looking at stuff through microscopes and a magnifying glass, I'm sorry to say that today's society would get pretty bored with that pretty quickly.
I want to defend the movie for a second, because every single one of those things that you just described happens in the movie. It takes all of about 3 minutes of the story, but every single one of those things you mentioned actually happens in the story.
Very true. But if it was an hour of the story as opposed to 3 minutes of the story, I think he probably wouldn't have a huge audience.
I agree. The way I look at this movie, it's as much of a reimagination of the Sherlock Holmes story as Battlestar Galactica was from the original Battlestar Galactica. Holmes has all of the characteristics that Arthur Conan Doyle wrote about. I mean, he's still a genius. He's still addicted to what we would classify, I guess, as drugs. I mean, he still is the CSI guy. I mean, he uses the microscope. He uses the magnifying glass. And he's out there solving the mystery. That's all part of it. But that's within the context of this being sold as an action-adventure movie. For all intents and purposes, this is a buddy cop movie. Sherlock Holmes is the cop and Watson is the buddy.
When we finished watching this movie, and yes, we were two of the many, many, many people who went out and saw it Christmas Day, I remember the first thought that clicked into my head as the credits were rolling was, that was a really, really good action-adventure film. I just wish that the Master Detective had had a mystery to solve.
And he did, but truly, it was very much secondary to the action-adventure story. I mean, he does have a moment at the end where he reveals all of the things that the audience doesn't know and how he figured out the mystery. I mean, that's still there, but it's not nearly as important as the chase scenes, as the explosions.
The mystery is still there. It's just not a question of who is the guilty party as much as how they did it. Because you know from the very beginning who the guilty party is. It's the guy who's in the commercials with him. I mean, come on.
Well, what I think that they did interesting, and I read a review recently where they said this movie begs for a sequel. And I disagree with it in so much as this movie was setting up the sequel. Moriarty is in this movie a significant amount of time in the background. He's not foremost on the screen. You probably only see him in 3 or 4 actual scenes. But he's not revealed until the last 2-3 minutes of the movie.
And even then, he's not even really revealed. Holmes is told that he's there, and that this guy who he's seen in the shadows is Moriarty. We never actually see his face.
It's not so much a begging for a second movie. Holmes' last words in the movie is, case reopened. It's basically saying, this is the end of part one.
But basically, there's nothing in this film that violates the parameters that was established by Doyle back in the original novels. There are things that are accentuated more than others, but they were always there. Speaking of reviews, that was one of the ones that really kind of bothered me, was a reviewer who said that Sherlock Holmes never fought, Sherlock Holmes never carried a gun, Sherlock Holmes never carried a sword. He did. He just didn't rely on them as much as he relied on his brain. It didn't mean that he was incapable of using them. In fact, in several of the stories, it is mentioned that Holmes is an accomplished fighter, and that he knows of the martial arts, and that he has carried a gun, and that he is a capable swordsman. All of these things are in the books if you've bothered to do any research whatsoever. It's just rarely at the forefront. This movie takes those traits and it moves it to the forefront and says, yeah, all that boring science stuff that 90% of the public just doesn't really care about anymore, we'll move that to the background. He still has it. It's still there. We just won't focus in on it as much. And we'll focus in on the fancy stuff that people care about these days.
We live in an MTV generation where people are used to getting all of their information in 7 seconds or less. And it's really hard to tell the CSI aspect of the story in 7 seconds or less. Not too hard to put a fight scene in that amount of time. Although Guy Ritchie is nowhere near the director that Christopher Nolan is, I hate to use the two directors in the same sentence, but this is Guy Ritchie's modernization of Sherlock Holmes doing what Christopher Nolan did to Batman. I think that's his honest attempt. Whether or not he succeeds is completely another story, but I think that's what he's trying to do.
I will say that this is probably the best Guy Ritchie film I've ever seen.
Yeah, that's not really very hard.
But at the same time, it's not at the Christopher Nolan Batman Begins level, to be honest.
No, it's not. I certainly wasn't trying to imply that. But Batman, very much so, is the world's greatest detective. He started out in Detective Comics. He is supposed to be the guy who knows the chemicals. He knows, oh, look, you have brown clay on your shoes. You must have been by the quarry. Batman knows all that stuff. All the other stuff he does, he's supposed to be not the best at. But he knows martial arts. He's a very good fighter. He knows computers and the other things. But he's the world's greatest detective.
But that tends to fall by the wayside when it comes to things like movies and TV shows and things like that. Because, like you said, you can only show a guy peering into a microscope for so long before people go, "Oh, wake me up when there's a fight scene."
You hit the nail right on the head, right where I was trying to take it. The Batman Begins movie was about Bruce Wayne's training in the martial arts and how he came upon the idea of theatricality and deception. It didn't describe how he became the world's greatest detective.
Right.
Sherlock Holmes didn't really describe why he was a nemesis to Scotland Yard, for the lack of a better term. He could out-detect any of them. It had to do more with, he did some out-thinking, but beating up on people, being around for explosions, you know, that kind of stuff.
The other complaint that I've heard, that I will then proceed to complain about, twist your head around that one for a moment, has to do with the fact that people were trying to figure out where this fell chronologically, which I think is stupid when you're talking about a reintroduction anyway. But no, this is not Sherlock Holmes meeting Dr. Watson for the first time. This isn't their first case together. This isn't even their 20th case together.
It's very ambiguous. I agree with you that it doesn't matter. All you need to know is Holmes is on the case already, and he's been working with Watson. That's really all that's important. I think it happened somewhere in the middle, two-thirds through the stories, if I had to put a guess on it. But I think that's really stupid to guess, because it's not important to the story.
In other words, just let it go and enjoy. Irene Adler, in the books, has the distinction of being the only woman that Sherlock Holmes has ever had any respect for. Which, on the surface, is kind of a crude thing to say by today's standards. But back in the 1880s, 1890s, women didn't get as much respect as they do now. Sorry to say it, but it's true. That being said, he respected her because she was the only woman who was as smart as he was and could outthink him. Which, for Sherlock Holmes, is high praise indeed. She is mentioned in a few other stories simply as the woman, and it's pretty clear that in spite of the fact that she outsmarted him, he has very fond memories of her, and thinks very fondly of her. A lot of people have translated this into, she's the only woman that he ever loved, which I don't have a problem with that translation. This movie has Irene Adler featured in it quite a bit. There are some people who complain that she's in the movie because they think of her as the character that was used once in the books, and therefore why should she get such a pertinent role in the film. But I think she adds several levels to the film, and not just her beauty.
I didn't have any problems with Irene Adler being in the film. I thought that she was an integral part of the plot and was used really well.
She was used really well, and she was used in a way that held to the characteristics that were shown in the books. Yes, she's Holmes's love interest, but she's not exactly above board. And yeah, she's pretty smart, and she gives him a run for his money. So I don't see whereas her presence violates anything that's come before. So those who are using that as a complaint, shut up!
What do you think about the movie's performances and its direction?
Well, Rachel McAdams, I thought, did a very good job portraying the intricacies that I was just talking about. I've heard some people say that Jude Law is too handsome and too thin to be a good Dr. Watson, but I think that they're reflecting far too much back onto previous portrayals as opposed to who the character really was in the books. I mean, if you're going to keep up with Sherlock Holmes, you can't be this portly guy who's waddling along, running out of breath after three blocks. You just can't be that guy. I didn't really have any problems with any of the performances. I thought Robert Downey Jr. did a decent job, but he wasn't able to take me out of the reality that this is Robert Downey Jr. playing Sherlock Holmes. There are some performances that you forget who the actor is and you get lost in the performance. Robert Downey Jr. wasn't able to do that for me.
You forget he's Robert Downey Jr. in his portrayal of Tony Stark. He's all Tony Stark in Iron Man.
Yeah, and he doesn't quite achieve that with Sherlock Holmes. It's not to say that he gives a bad performance. It's just Robert Downey Jr. as Sherlock Holmes. It's not Sherlock Holmes.
I'm going to paraphrase another review that I read on this. I read so many reviews in preparing for this cast, and I really hit the negative ones.
Wait, Doug, you prepared for a podcast?
Yes, I did. Believe it or not. One particular reviewer, I won't mention his name, and I'm just going to paraphrase him, but he said, "I absolutely hate Guy Ritchie, but I'm going to review this movie because of the hype anyways." And that was literally his first two sentences of his review. And I'm paraphrasing, but that's what he said.
That's when you go to one of the other reporters slash film critics, whatever, and you say, "I'm sorry, I can't be unbiased about this film. Would you mind taking care of the review on this one for me?" You don't write in your review, "Yeah, I knew that I was going to hate this well before I ever saw it, so here's why I think it sucks, because Guy Ritchie directed it."
And literally, this particular review spent half of the inch space talking about why Guy Ritchie was a bad director and how bad his previous movies were. So literally, half of the review had nothing to do with the movie. He proceeded with the final half of the review to tell you all of the reasons everything that Guy Ritchie did was wrong. Why Robert Downey Jr. was a terrible Sherlock Holmes, why this was Jude Law's worst performance, why by the end of the music you will never be able to listen to this composer's scores ever again because they're going to be scratched into your brain so badly. I'm not going to do that to you. I'll just share with you that I don't like that reviewer.
Wait, there is a score to this movie?
Oh, it's incredible. I love the score. Arguably, I would actually say that the score was probably the best thing about the movie. It was so incredible.
Yeah, I realized that Matt would smack me right upside the head, but I honestly didn't realize that there was that much of a score until, again, I was doing my research. I'm one of those weird people who kind of just acknowledges the fact that there's background music playing and I don't really listen to it. Yes, Matt, I will slap myself upside the head later for you. Don't worry about it.
I'll start with Guy Ritchie. Guy Ritchie is not a good director. I can't really defend him. I think he made a lot of really interesting choices. For some people, they worked, and for others, they didn't. I happen to be one of the people they worked for. I mean, I've seen a lot of bad reviews that they did not like the fight scenes because they made Holmes incredibly cerebral. They were just like, "I'm going to do this, and it's going to damage him this way. I'm going to do this, and it's going to damage him this way." And I was thinking how absolutely appropriate that was for Sherlock Holmes. He's just not a blind fighter. He knows every single punch he's going to throw.
I absolutely loved that fact. That was the best use of a fight scene that I can ever think of from a film. Because of the fact that he took the character, he took what the character is known for, and he tied it into what he needed to provide to his audience. Sherlock Holmes is a genius. He knows medicine. He knows all the sciences. He knows that if he punches somebody in the jaw, that not only is this going to have the effect, but it's going to have exactly this effect because he probably knows the pounds per square inch pressure that his fist makes. No, he probably hasn't measured it because they didn't have that back then, but he knows! I mean, he's freaking Sherlock Holmes, for Pete's sake!
It's funny because the thought process, as we talked about earlier, you can't do these long, drawn-out scenes of lab work, but they probably spent 5 to 10 seconds with Holmes explaining to you exactly what he's going to do. Okay, I'm going to punch him, you know, once on the left side of the jaw to loosen it, and then I'm going to punch him on the right side of the jaw to completely dislocate it. All right, he's got 3 cracked ribs. I'm going to punch him in the cracked ribs to break the ribs, and then I'm going to punch him in the diaphragm so he loses all of his air. I mean, he really thinks about it. And then the film speeds up, and it shows you, like, all these punches in about half a second.
And the fact that it's having the exact effect that he predicted that they would.
I really liked it. Now, I understand that was a director choice, that was an editing choice to do stuff like that. For me, it worked.
If they had shown Sherlock Holmes to be just a street brawler who swung his fists and didn't think about what was going on, that would have been uncharacteristic, in my opinion.
I agree. Again, I'm not trying to say that Guy Ritchie is the greatest director of the world. I've seen 2 movies this week. I've seen Sherlock Holmes and Avatar. If you want, I could spend the next 2 hours telling you why Avatar was the best movie of the year, possibly of the decade. I can't say that about Sherlock Holmes. Sure, I enjoyed Sherlock Holmes. It was exactly the entertainment I was looking for. But I'll say it a third time, Guy Ritchie is not Christopher Nolan.
Honestly, when you are a director with multiple films under your belt, and the thing that you are the best known for is being Mr. Madonna, I think that kind of says it for itself. He was Mr. Madonna to me before this film. now I can at least sit there and go, oh yeah, he was the guy who directed Sherlock Holmes.
I think that's a good way to look at it. Performance-wise, I wasn't put off by Robert Downey Jr. I don't think he was necessarily as good as he was as Tony Stark, but he still brought me in to believe he was Sherlock Holmes. Jude Law in these period pieces is outstanding. I don't know what else to say about Jude Law, except for the fact that he can really pull you in and believe he is John Watson.
Yes, he was a far better John Watson, in my opinion, than Robert Downey Jr. was a Sherlock Holmes. Like I said, nothing against Robert Downey Jr.'s performance. It's just by the first 3/4 of an hour, I wasn't seeing Jude Law on the screen. I was seeing Dr. Watson.
Pretty much all the performances were really spot on. They were really what they needed to be.
A little while ago, you mentioned Sherlock Holmes' addiction to cocaine. And actually, I think it's opium that they've decided that he must have been addicted to. There are hints that, yes, he had some form of habit in the books, but I'm not quite sure that they went into such great detail as he's addicted to this particular thing. And while I definitely stand in the camp of say no to drugs, the quote-unquote reason for his drug habit is that with his brain the way it is, constantly working, constantly trying to find answers, the only real way that he had ever found to shut it off was by partaking in narcotics. That being said, I don't necessarily like it when the flaws of my heroes get shoved to the forefront. It's one thing to acknowledge that they're there and say, okay, they've got flaws just like anybody else. But when people try to focus in solely on that type of thing, it sometimes bothers me. So one of my hopes for this film was that they weren't going to try to shove his drug abuse down our throats, for a lack of a better term.
I think they succeeded. After, in the opening of the movie, he solves his big case, and then the movie kind of like takes a jump 3 months later, and you find out that he's had no cases, and he's been on a 3-month bender. They don't shove it in your face, they just show you John Watson saying, okay, time to take a bath.
Sherlock Holmes is a character that has been around for over 120 years now. In order for a character to stick around that long, there has to be something for people to care about and something for people to connect with. And I know fully well that that's the reason why people delve into his drug addictions and his sexual orientation and all these background details that really don't have any impact on him as a master detective. But when people try to draw those points out and try to use them as a banner, like I said, that kind of bothers me. The 3-month bender. They said, yeah, it's there. There was another scene where Watson says, you know that what you're drinking is used for eye surgery. They let you know that, yeah, they acknowledge that there's this tendency there, but they didn't focus in on it. So that being said, does this movie sacrifice mystery for action and adventure?
Absolutely. There's no doubt about it. The movie itself is not a mystery to the audience. It's only a mystery to the characters in the movie.
And I'm not even 100% sure that it's a mystery to the characters in the movie. I mean, Holmes makes it pretty clear that he's known from step to step to step what was going on.
He's the only one, though. Nobody else in the movie knew why Lord Blackwood didn't die from being hanged. Nobody else in the movie knew why John Watson declared him dead when he didn't die from being hanged. No one else in the movie knew how he was able to break out of his tomb when he was supposed to be dead. These were facts that only Sherlock Holmes knew.
For me, as a lover of mysteries, I prefer to be given clues along the way, giving me the chance to be a detective myself and solve the crime as the detective is doing it. A good mystery provides you with clues, leads you up to the reveal, does the reveal, has the reveal be something that is fair to the reader, audience member. In other words, you don't whip out some character in the last 5 pages and say, oh yeah, he did it, and you've never seen the character before at any point in the story. That is what makes up good detective fiction to me. And honestly, this movie didn't have that. You knew from the very beginning who the character was. There really weren't any clues leading up to things. It was just, this is who did it, and we'll tell you along the way how he did it. Don't worry about it.
This is something that I have to actually fault Guy Ritchie for. Because Guy Ritchie actually changed something in this movie. The A story was the red herring, and the B story was the mystery. And he did provide you with all the clues. probably one of the most important scenes in the movie to reveal the B story mystery is Holmes has this electrical device. He doesn't know what the device is, but he knows it's giving electrical shocks to the big bad guy. And I'm not going to bother giving anybody a spoiler alert because at this point it's a little late. The actual device that Moriarty wants is not the big bomb at the end of the movie. It's the electrical device that Holmes was playing with halfway through the movie, which is essentially a Marconi. The whole movie is about how does Moriarty get the device that can transmit radio waves. This actually kind of leads into your other point about steampunk.
Well, you led into it, so let's go into it. Did Holmes merge well with steampunk? And perhaps we should start out by giving a definition of what steampunk is.
Feel free, my friend.
Steampunk is a version of science fiction that is actually set in the past, but that uses either modern-day devices or futuristic devices for that time period in its storytelling.
Yes, essentially telling Victorian-era stories with high technology.
Things like Sherlock Holmes having a taser.
It wasn't a taser. It was an electromagnetic generator.
Yeah, but up until the point where that particular little piece of the mystery is revealed,
he used it as a taser. Two-part answer to this question. The amount of steampunk that was in this movie was used well and integrated well. I thought as a use of steampunk, it was on the weak side.
I will agree with you by saying he made good use of steampunk. I just seriously doubt that Guy Ritchie knows what steampunk is.
All he did is steal a little bit of thunder from the old television show Wild Wild West. That was one of the hooks in Wild Wild West, as every week there was some sort of technology or some sort of mystery that involved a piece of technology that could not have possibly been invented in the Old West. Just going back on some storylines, I remember atomic bombs being used. I remember tanks being used. There was all sorts of technology that didn't exist that they were sent out to find and capture.
If he was shooting for an homage to that type of storytelling, he did a very good job. It just so happens that Wild Wild West is also a pretty decent example of steampunk. I mean, Sherlock Holmes essentially carried around a utility fanny pack, for lack of a better term. It wasn't a utility belt. It was this thing that he had rolled up that he kept on his back hip that when he needed it, he spun it around, unclasped it, and it fell open and all of his tools were right there where he needed it. It was very Batman-esque, only it was more in the form of a fanny pack.
Yeah, but there was nothing technology-driven about it. It was basically like a lockpick set.
Well, even for that time period, it could be argued that a lockpick set would be steampunk-esque.
I don't think so. I guess we're arguing splitting hairs here. But to me, a steampunk-type lockpick set would be putting a mechanical device on the lock of a door that had a clockwork mechanism. So you twisted the clockwork mechanism, you see it unwinding, and when it goes, bing! The door opens.
Great, you're opening doors with toasters now. Wonderful! Yeah, you're right. It's semantics, and we don't need to spend a whole lot of time arguing semantics. You're wrong, and I'm right.
Exactly what I would have said. You're wrong, and I'm right.
Considering the fact that outside of the science fiction community, the term steampunk is probably a completely foreign concept, though, I don't think very many people would have exactly noticed it for what it was. And that's okay. It blended in fairly smoothly, and it didn't feel significantly out of place.
It was all right. It was used well. Well, I guess all that's left is the pocket protector. Overall, as a movie, it was enjoyable, so I'd give it 3 pens in the pocket protector.
I'm actually going to go with 2.5 pens. It was better than average, but didn't knock my socks off either. So I'll go with 2.5.
And as Jamie and Adam have proved, it's very hard to knock a person's socks off. Once again, we thank you for listening to TwerpCast. We solicit your thoughts and or feedback. Please write Jim at twerponline.net. We can also be found on Zanga, MySpace, and Facebook.
This has been a production of Timewell Electronic Recording Productions, copyright 2009. Thanks for listening, and see you next year!
Elementary, dear Watson.